Pacifica. This is Democracy Now!
I'm honored and grateful that President Trump has nominated me for the position of administrator.
Please remove, please restore order. The officers, please restore order in the committee room.
Protesters disrupt the confirmation hearing of former coal lobbyist Andrew Wheeler to head the Environmental Protection Agency. We'll air highlights from the hearing and look at Wheeler's record downplaying the climate crisis. But first, federal workers stage protests across the country as the government shutdown enters its 27th day. With Barbara Ehrenreich, author of Nickel and Dimed, about her call for TSA workers to go on strike. Plus, we look at how the shutdown is disproportionately impacting Native Americans.
Our communities rely on federal funding to administer key government services, healthcare facilities, public safety, housing access, nutrition and food distribution, and social services.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi called Wednesday for President Trump to cancel the State of the Union address later this month, arguing the government shutdown has left the Secret Service and the Department of Homeland Security starved for funds and unprepared to simultaneously protect all three branches of government.
That we would have the President of the United States, the Vice President of the United States, the entire Congress of the United States, House and Senate, the Supreme Court, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the Cabinet of the United States, did I say that, and the Diplomatic Corps, all in the same room. This is and requires hundreds of people working on the logistics and the security of it. Most of those people are either furloughed or victims of the shutdown, the president's shutdown.
Speaker Pelosi said Trump should cancel the State of the Union, move it to a later date, or submit it in writing. Republicans dismissed Pelosi's warning as a political stunt. Meanwhile, the longest government shutdown in U.S. history, now in its 27th day, continues to punish more than 800,000 federal workers who've gone without a paycheck since December 22nd. Workers rallied at airports in Sacramento, California, Baltimore, Maryland, Wednesday, building on similar protests, warning the shutdown is threatening aviation security. There are reports of skyrocketing absences among federal workers forced to work without pay. On Capitol Hill, federal contractors held a protest outside the offices of Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and other Republicans, saying the shutdown threatens to deprive some 4 million contract workers of hundreds of millions of dollars in expected payments. On Wednesday, President Trump signed legislation that will grant back pay to federal workers once the shutdown is resolved, but there's no indication that will come anytime soon and will not apply to federal contractors. The Trump administration is planning a massive expansion of the Pentagon's anti-ballistic missile program on a scale not seen since President Reagan's Star Wars initiatives of the 1980s. Trump's expected to announce the plan during a scheduled stop at the Pentagon today. The planned announcement comes as the Trump administration withdrawing the United States from the landmark Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty on Nuclear Arms signed with Russia in 1987. President Trump's nominee to lead the Environmental Protection Agency, former coal lobbyist Andrew Wheeler, told senators Wednesday he believes climate change is real but doesn't consider it the biggest crisis facing the planet. This is Andrew Wheeler being questioned by Vermont Independent Senator Bernie Sanders at the confirmation hearing.
Mr. Wheeler, President Trump has indicated his belief that climate change is a hoax, perhaps perpetrated by the Chinese. Do you agree?
Well, I believe that climate change is real. I believe that man has an impact on it. And
the president has said that climate change is a hoax. Do you agree with him?
I've not used the hoax word myself.
Wheeler has been the acting head of the EPA since Scott Pruitt resigned in July amidst an onslaught of financial and ethics scandals. Wheeler's a former lobbyist for Murray Energy, the nation's largest underground coal mining company. We'll have more on Wheeler after headlines. In more climate news, a new study finds Earth's oceans reached their warmest temperature in recorded history in 2018, an ominous sign that greenhouse gas emissions are fueling rising seas and ever more powerful storms. The analysis published in the journal Advances in Atmospheric Sciences finds ocean warming has accelerated sharply since the 90s at a pace that's much faster than previously recognized. In Syria, a suicide bomber struck a restaurant in the northern city of Manbij on Wednesday, killing 19 people, including four Americans, two of them U.S. troops. The bombing was claimed by ISIS and came just weeks after President Trump declared victory over the group and ordered U.S. troops to withdraw from Syria, prompting the resignation of Pentagon Chief Jim Mattis. Just hours after the attack, Vice President Mike Pence said in a speech, ISIS has been defeated and the caliphate has crumbled. Wednesday's attack drew renewed calls from congressional hawks, both Republicans and Democrats, to reverse Trump's Syria withdrawal. The U.S. has an estimated 2,000 troops stationed in Syria, even though Congress has never declared war on Syria. In Zimbabwe, at least five people have been killed and hundreds more arrested after government forces moved to suppress nationwide protests against the government's move to more than double the cost of fuel. As protests began Monday, the government shut down internet access nationwide and deployed the military to the streets of Harare and other cities. Hundreds of people were reportedly beaten and arrested as authorities raided homes.
Soldiers broke into our house in the middle of the night, destroying property in the process. They took turns to beat us, and our room was full of blood.
They had no mercy. They wanted to kill us, but I managed to escape.
Fuel prices in Zimbabwe are now among the most expensive in the world. In Kenya, the death toll from Tuesday's attack on a luxury hotel in the capital, Nairobi, has risen to 21, plus five assailants, with Kenya's Red Cross warning 50 people remain missing. In a statement, the Somalia-based Al-Shabaab group claimed the assault was retaliation for President Trump's decision to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. Among the dead was at least one U.S. citizen, businessman Jason Spindler, who in 2001 survived the September 11th attacks on the World Trade Center. British Prime Minister Theresa May survived a no-confidence vote in the House of Commons Wednesday, one day after her Brexit plan to withdraw from the European Union was crushed in an historic defeat. It's the first time a British leader has held power after losing such an important parliamentary battle. This is Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn speaking just after lawmakers signaled their confidence in the Prime Minister.
Last night, the House rejected the government's deal, emphatically. A week ago, the House voted to condemn the idea of a no-deal Brexit. Before there can be any positive discussions about the way forward, the government must remove clearly, once and for all, the prospect of the catastrophe of a no-deal Brexit in the EU and all the chaos that would come as a result of that.
There's no clear path forward for Britain, which is just 10 weeks before a deadline to withdraw from the European Union. The New York Times reports President Trump's inaugural committee received an unprecedented $107 million from private donors, at least twice the amount raised by any of Trump's predecessors. Despite the lavish spending, Trump's inauguration was far smaller affair than President Obama's first inauguration in 2008, with just three official inaugural balls and a fraction of the crowd size. It's not known how most of the money was spent, but among expenses uncovered by the Times was $1.5 million paid to the Trump International Hotel in Washington, D.C. The New York Times report came as the Inspector General for the General Services Administration said Wednesday the agency ignored concerns that Donald Trump's lease on the federally owned building that houses the Trump International Hotel violates violates anti-corruption clauses of the Constitution. The inspector general said after Trump's election, regulators failed to consider whether Trump's continued lease violated the emoluments clause, which bar the president from receiving payments from foreign leaders or U.S. states. Meanwhile, the Washington Post reports that top executives of T-Mobile booked thousands of dollars worth of stays at Donald Trump's Washington, D.C. hotel just one day after their company announced plans for a $26 billion merger with Sprint. The Post reports the executives have repeatedly returned to the hotel for at least 38 nights as they seek the Trump administration's approval for the merger. President Trump's personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani, falsely claimed Wednesday he never said there was no collusion between Russia and Trump's 2016 campaign. Giuliani was speaking to CNN's Chris Cuomo.
I never said there was no collusion between the campaign or between people in the campaign.
Yes,
I have no idea. I said the president of the United States. There is not a single bit of evidence the president of the United States committed the only crime you could commit here, conspired with the Russians to hack the DNC.
Giuliani's statement directly contradicts his past comments made as recently as last July, stating nobody in the Trump campaign colluded with Russia. Giuliani's shifting claims came amidst new revelations about former Trump campaign chair Paul Manafort's efforts to share internal polling data with a suspected Russian intelligence operative named Konstantin Klimnik. Michigan State University's interim president says he'll resign next week amidst a furor over his comments about survivors of former sports doctor Larry Nassar, who's been convicted of sexually abusing hundreds of women and girls. The interim president, former Michigan Governor John Engler, told the Detroit Free Press last week that women who were sexually assaulted by Nassar are in the spotlight and, quote, still enjoying that moment at times, you know, the awards and recognition, he said. The comments prompted Michigan State administrators and the Board of Trustees to demand Engler's resignation. His predecessor, Luana Simon, will go on trial later this month facing charges she lied to police as they investigated Dr. Nassar's crimes. She faces up to 4 years in prison. In Los Angeles, the union representing more than 31,000 teachers is set to resume bargaining today with the Los Angeles Unified School District as a strike by educators enters its fourth day. Teachers are demanding smaller class sizes, higher pay, the regulation of charter schools, and more nurses, counselors, and librarians. Elsewhere in New York State, police arrested four people Wednesday as they used tractors to block a road to the construction site of a massive gas-fired power plant. Although New York banned fracking in 2014, activists say the 1,100-megawatt plant in Wingdale would rely on imports of fracked gas from other states. And on Wall Street, the investment giant BlackRock was forced to deny Wednesday it's taking bold action on climate change after the activist group, the Yes Men, sent reporters a hoax letter posing as BlackRock CEO Larry Fink. The letter claimed BlackRock would require companies it invests in to align their business models with the goals of the Paris Climate Agreement. After the Financial Times, CNBC, and other media outlets ran with the story, BlackRock tweeted, "Don't be fooled by imitations. Larry's real CEO letter coming soon," unquote. As the world's largest investment company, BlackRock is also the world's largest owner of fossil fuel companies and has been the target of environmentalists and shareholder activists calling on it to divest from coal, oil and gas. Meanwhile, the Yes Men struck in Washington, D.C. Wednesday, circulating a phony version of The Washington Post proclaiming the end of the Donald Trump era. The phony newspaper featured the Post's familiar masthead with the altered slogan, "Democracy Awakens in Action." And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The longest government shutdown in U.S. history is now on day 27. As 800,000 federal workers continue to go without pay, federal employees around the country are rising up to demand an end to the shutdown, which has run public institutions ragged and left hundreds of thousands financially strapped. On Capitol Hill, federal contractors held a protest outside the office of Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and other Republicans, saying the shutdown threatens to deprive some 4 million contract workers of hundreds of millions of dollars in expected payments. There are reports of skyrocketing absences among federal workers forced to work without pay. This is Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez delivering her first speech on the floor of the House.
The truth of this shutdown is that it's actually not about a wall, it is not about the border, and it is certainly not about the well-being of everyday Americans. The truth is, this shutdown is about the erosion of American democracy and the subversion of our most basic governmental norms. It is not normal to hold 800,000 workers' paychecks hostage. It is not normal to shut down the government when we don't get what we want. It is not normal for public servants to run away and hide from the public that they serve. And it is certainly not normal to starve the people we serve for a proposal that is wildly unpopular among the American people.
That was New York Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi called Wednesday for President Trump to cancel his State of the Union address later this month, arguing the government shutdown has left the Secret Service and Department of Homeland Security starved for funds and unprepared to simultaneously protect all three branches of government. Meanwhile, the Transportation Security Administration has become a flashpoint for growing outrage over the mistreatment of federal workers due to the shutdown. In Florida, the Tampa Airport has set up a food bank for unpaid TSA workers. In Phoenix, Arizona, a food bank served nearly 300 TSA employees from a mobile pantry. TSA workers rallied in airports in Sacramento, California, and Baltimore, Maryland, Wednesday, warning that the shutdown is threatening aviation security. Hundreds more around the country have been calling in sick, with the agency reporting more than 6% unscheduled absences in what some are calling a blue flu protest. On Wednesday, TSA employees protested outside Dallas-Fort Worth International Airport and the Los Angeles International Airport. This is TSA union leader Bobby Orozco speaking in Los Angeles, where TSA agents signed up for food cards after rallying.
So as you see behind me, a lot of the folks are getting food, you know, trying to get whatever they can get in order to survive. I mean, right now it's just high anxiety. Not only did we not get our last paycheck, but it seems very likely that we may not get our next paycheck.
As TSA workers continue to go without pay, airports are experiencing staggeringly long security lines and a host of other problems. The TSA recently acknowledged a man with a loaded pistol passed through airport security at Atlanta International Airport. Well, we turn now to someone who says it's time for TSA workers to strike. In Washington, D.C., we're joined by Barbara Ehrenreich, the author of the best-selling book Nickel and Dimed, on Not Getting By in America. She's also the founder of the Economic Hardship Reporting Project and recently wrote a piece for the New York Times headlined, It's Time for TSA Workers to Strike. Barbara Ehrenreich, welcome to Democracy Now! Talk about the shutdown, its effect on workers, and what your demand is.
Well, I should say that my co-author on this piece is a longtime union organizer who was, in fact, at one point the director of organizing for the Teamsters, also worked for government workers unions. So there's a lot of experience that goes into this little op-ed we did for the New York Times. And our point is don't just take this lying down. Yes, there's the blue flu and there's, you know, people looking for other jobs and everything. But look at the way airport workers and federal employees in general are being treated. They're being treated in a mean and humiliating fashion. When Trump said this week, essentially, you can come back to work, but, you know, you'll get paid at some point. We can't tell you exactly when the shutdown is over. That's not how you respectfully treat American workers. The idea is you work for money. Otherwise, it's in violation of the 13th Amendment, which bans involuntary servitude and slavery.
Is there a ban on federal workers striking?
Yeah. Yeah, there are plenty of bans. There were last year, 2018, when there were teachers' strikes all over the country, five different states. Those were illegal strikes, you know, technically speaking. I mean, especially in the public sector, the right to strike has been so limited. So you have to go ahead anyway. In the 60s and in the 70s, there's a tremendous amount of public sector worker organizing, all illegal. I mean, striking as well as organizing. So,
I want to turn to Lamar Cobb, lead TSA officer at Baltimore-Washington International Airport.
I have a little 10-year-old daughter that is my pride and joy. She's my heart. I actually had to take her out of cheerleading because I didn't have the money to pay for her to continue it. It's hard. It is. It's as a man personally, and my daughter being my pride and joy. Meeting end meets, like, we don't make a lot, like everybody thinks. Like, oh, you know, you're supposed to have 3 to 6 months savings. But that's hard when you're not making that much to have 3 to 6 months savings and you have bills and you got to figure out if you want to pay your car payment or if you want to pay your rent or your life insurance. You have to basically pick options. It's been very hard, actually. Especially when you do it on your own, you know.
So that's Lamar Cobb, lead TSA officer at Baltimore Washington International Airport. What's astounding about all of this, Barbara, is that President Trump says he's doing this for national security. And yet among those who are hardest hit are those who enforce national security, the TSA workers, the border guards. The Coast Guard, for the first time, is not being paid.
Well, yes, but please don't ask me to explain anything Trump does. You know, another element in all this, and I'm not being conspiratorial here, but one of the goals of the far right in this country for a long time has been to shrink government, or at least shrink the parts of government that they don't like, the parts like welfare, as they call it, or Social Security, et cetera. And that's what—that may be the part of the motivation and certainly part of the outcome of the shutdown, because you have so many TSA workers, for example. And I focus on them because they're among the lowest paid of airport workers, not counting the people who push the wheelchairs and clean the bathrooms. But they, you know, they're low paid. And they have to eventually look for other work. And maybe that's the idea. Just shrink the workforce. And then you can say, well, we didn't do it. They walked away from the job. So
You know, it's interesting you should raise this, Barbara. I wanted to turn now to Fox News, which, how they're covering the shutdown. In this clip, you'll hear Steve Doocy of Fox and Friends. But first, Fox contributor Charlie Hurt.
You could shut down half of the government agencies, and literally it would be years, if it were not for the media, it would be years before the regular person, the normal average working American, would even know that the department had been shut down in terms of, how much it affects their lives.
A lot of people across the country don't even notice that part of the federal government is shut down.
Barbara Ehrenreich, your response.
Well, I think a lot of people are noticing it. I mean, think of all the groups affected, the contractors who, as you mentioned, Amy, actually had a sort of demonstration, the federal government contractors, and all their employees, which amounted to what? They estimated 4 million around the country?
I mean, this is very significant. You're talking about outside Mitch McConnell's office, because these millions of people, of course, there was a much smaller group in front of McConnell's office, but they will never be paid. These are not workers that are paid directly by the government.
Mm-hmm. No, the reverberations of this are very easy to see, certainly here in the Washington, D.C. area, which has so many government workers, federal workers. But there are things like food stamps that depend on being processed by federal agencies. So many things. Income tax collection, well, they've straightened that out a little bit because they need the money. But there's a huge impact. And if enough airport workers were to either walk away from the job or go on strike, that would shut down the airports. And that would just shut down the economy. I think even Trump wouldn't let that last for more than a few hours. So that's one possibility. And I think that what we're saying in this op-ed piece is it's more dignified to strike than to be just used as pawns and then very quietly, one by one, walk away from the job perhaps, get a second or third job. There should be a collective action. There should be some sense of principle, that just some response to the insulting way so many workers are being treated right now by Trump, which, you know, puts me in mind of the way he treated Jeff Sessions before Jeff Sessions was thrown out, essentially. He tortured that man for months. And in a sense, we have that kind of humiliation process now going on with government workers. Mm. Oh, you can come to work. We just won't pay you.
Bob Henley, the veteran labor reporter, wrote at Salon saying, why not a general strike in support of the 800,000 federal workers currently not receiving a paycheck?
That's fine. You know, I just that's an awfully big undertaking. I think the iron is hot right now around these federal agencies. I don't know how, you know, anybody want to call general strike, I'll get behind it. But it's just a very hard kind of thing to do.
I wanted to go to one of the agencies that has been shut down, talking about the various places in the country. I wanted to go to the Coast Guard. These are, you know, very unusual. One branch of the military that'll be impacted by the government shutdown is the Coast Guard. It's 42,000 active duty members will miss a paycheck for the first time in history. The Coast Guard Support Program published a 5-page tip sheet titled Managing Your Finances During a Furlough, which was obtained by the Washington Post. The tip sheet suggests Coast Guard members stay financially afloat during the shutdown by holding a garage sale, babysitting, and dog walking. Barbara yes, Ehrenreich. They're also, of course, setting up food banks throughout the country.
Well, that actually, the Coast Guard had to take that down off its website because they had so much mockery at the suggestion that workers could support themselves by dog walking and garage sales. No, this is laughable, insulting responses. I think a strike might be a good thing is it would help to reignite the old, you know, fighting spirit of American labor. I come from a tradition of union people who did not take certain kinds of crap. They just that's it. You know, at a certain point, you go on strike and assert your dignity and make your demands and your problems known to the general public in every way you can. So I think this would be the moment.
So As you go back in time, Barbara, I wanted to go to 1981, to PATCO, the Professional Air Traffic Controllers Organization, when it went on strike to protest wages and working conditions, this famous moment when President Ronald Reagan responded by firing the 11,000 highly skilled workers, replacing them with military personnel. This is Reagan speaking August 3rd, 1981.
I must tell those who fail to report for duty this morning, they are in violation of the law, and if they do not report for work within 48 hours, they have forfeited their jobs and will be terminated.
That's President Reagan in 1981, breaking PATCO. Describe what happened next.
Well, the impact of PATCO was to terrify the unions. After that, there was much less talk of strikes. And the ghost of PATCO hangs over the unions today. Say anything about the need for a possible strike, and, you know, somebody's going to say, but look what happened to PATCO. My biggest response to that is to go from 1981 to 2018, when we saw a wave of strikes around the country, teacher strikes. And as I mentioned, those were, in most cases, illegal strikes. And people did it anyway. And that inspired or helped inspire other forms of labor militancy. You know, that when people see that someone stands up to gross injustice and insulting behavior, then that person is empowered to stand up too.
So at the very top of your New York Times op-ed, you write, last week in a meeting with Democratic leaders, President Trump called the government shutdown a strike. He called the government shutdown the strike. Can you explain this?
No, I can't explain that. But you know, it was like some desperate effort to shift the blame. You know, he's always blaming the Democrats for the shutdown, and here he made a stupid bid to blame the workers themselves for the shutdown. So, you know, I'm saying, why not just call it a strike? You're not being paid anyway, and maybe you will come out of this with greater power over the conditions of your work.
I wanted to turn to Dallas Airport, to the federal workers protesting outside Dallas-Fort Worth International Airport. This is Sarah Fry speaking to CBS.
It's your neighbors. Your neighbors are the ones having this anxiety, having this stress. We just bought a new house in June, and I've been aggressively paying down my student loans, and I expected to have a paycheck. I planned on working all through the holidays, and it's really tough and it's really stressful.
And you have a State Department employee who told The Washington Post the government shutdown's putting a strain on his colleagues and him.
It honestly makes me really sad thinking about people worried right now, sitting at home, eating dinners with their families and not knowing whether or not the next paycheck is coming in. Nobody should ever be in that position. And I don't think that those of us who signed up for the government ever— we never wanted to see anything like that happen. I've been through furloughs before, back in the 90s. And quite frankly, it was frightening back then. Okay, and I think that civil servants in particular, and I will say this also on behalf of my Foreign Service colleagues, my military colleagues, all of us deserve a little bit more respect.
So we're talking about millions of people affected. Finally, Barbara Ehrenreich, let's go back to the beginning and the headline of your op-ed. Why do you think in particular, if TSA workers struck, if the airports were closed, it would end the government shutdown immediately?
Because business would be so directly impacted. You know, who's in the airports on a normal weekday? It's business people traveling from one meeting in one city to another. If they couldn't do that, well, maybe they'd learn to Skype, which would be a good thing. But, you know, there would be—the impact would be immediate and very serious. And affecting business, that would mean phone calls would be made to Washington and things would get straightened out pretty fast.
And finally, Nancy Pelosi's response to President Trump, because she has to invite him into the House for the State of the Union, a great theatrical affair, saying go back to what they did for years, the presidents. You can just write down your State of the Union address, your report about the country, or wait till the government shutdown is over. But you're not welcome here now. Too dangerous, she said.
Right. She feels they don't have the security forces. But it's great. It's so wonderful to see Nancy Pelosi develop this strong spine recently and stand up to Trump and in the process infuriate him.
Barbara Ehrenreich, I want to thank you for being with us, author of the bestseller Nickel and Dimed on Not Getting By in America, also founder of the Economic Hardship Reporting Project. Barbara Ehrenreich recently wrote a piece, we'll link to it, in the New York Times. That piece, written with Gary Stevenson, called It's Time for TSA Workers to Strike. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, how is this affecting Native America, Indian country? Stay with us.
Only the guilty cry. Only the guilty cry. And that is why you never stop crying. Because you're guilty of lying and hurting me. Only the guilty feel shame. Only the guilty feel shame. And that is why you never can face me. Because you know you're to blame for all my misery and pain.
Only the Guilty Cry by Clyde King and the Sweet Things. Clyde King died January 7th at the age of 75. She was a legendary backing vocalist who worked with some of the biggest names in music, including the Rolling Stones' Linda Ronstadt and Bob Dylan. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman as we continue to look at the devastating impact of the longest government shutdown in U.S. history. Now turning to Native America, communities feeling its effects at a disproportionate rate. Native Americans reporting shortages of medicine as the Indian Health Service goes understaffed while a federally funded food delivery program to Indian reservations has halted. In a recent letter sent to President Trump, a coalition of Native groups wrote, on tribal lands, the federal government assumed the responsibility to provide basic governmental services like health care, public safety, and education as a part of its treaty negotiations with tribal nations. The Bureau of Indian Affairs and the Indian Health Service, the primary agencies responsible for providing these services either directly or through compact and contracts with tribal governments, are both currently hamstrung by the shutdown, they wrote. Democratic Congress members held a hearing Tuesday on the effects of the shutdown on health, education, employment in Native communities. Aaron Payment, chair of Sault Ste. Marie Tribe of Chippewa Indians, spoke at the hearing.
The shutdown violates the trust responsibility to tribal governments and adds to the trail of broken treaties. Federal agencies that provide critical government services to our nations are caught up in unrelated politics over funding for a southern border wall. Meanwhile, our tribal welfare hangs in the balance. No matter who is at fault, the shutdown threatens to abrogate the treaty and trust obligation to tribes. Federal funding that tribes receive is woefully inadequate to begin with, yet is based on the cessation of 500 million acres of land that American Indian tribes ceded to the federal government. My tribe and four other tribes in Michigan in the 1836 Treaty of Washington ceded 14 million acres of land in exchange for our rights to hunt and gather and fish and health, education, and social welfare into perpetuity. Tribes prepaid in full for our federal funding. Since we cannot foreclose on the land, we expect the federal government to fulfill the treaty and trust responsibility. I'm here to remind the Trump administration that your mortgage payment is due.
For more, we go to Washington, D.C., where we're joined by Mark Trahant, editor of Indian Country Today, member of the Shoshone-Bannock tribes. Mark, describe what's happening as a result of the shutdown to Indian Country.
It really is, across the country, a pretty significant, devastating impact. And health would be a great one, where people are worried about access to medicine, access to basic services. The Indian Health Service is still operating, but folks are not being paid. It's getting harder to refer people outside of the system. One stat that most people don't know is that 60% of the Indian health system is actually run by tribes or nonprofit organizations, not the federal government. So to have those organizations have to basically bail out the federal government is really extraordinary.
Talk about the number of federal workers who are Native American, or the number of Native Americans who are federal workers.
Most of the employees across the board at the Indian Health Service is the largest employer in Indian country, direct employer, over 10,000 people. It's interesting, we mentioned the Coast Guard earlier, but there are actually seven uniformed branches of the United States, and three of those branches, the Coast Guard, the NOAA officers, and the Public Health Service, are all in different aspects of this shutdown. And in many reservation clinics, it's the Public Health Service that has physicians and dentists and some of the other folks serving tribal members.
And what do you think about the fact that the whole shutdown is based on President Trump wanting to build this wall on the southern border?
It really is crazy, especially when you think that it's not a $5.7 billion project. It's just a down payment. And if this is to go and to end, it's going to be a much longer term, because we're really talking about $25 or $30 or $40 billion. And this dispute is not going to go away unless there's a resolution. And that's why I think it's so important that the conversation get broader than just what it is.
You know, we just played that clip from the congressional hearing. What difference does it make that we have this first, just this month? Two Native American women, for the first time, have entered Congress. You have Deb Haaland from New Mexico, as well as Charisse Davids from Kansas. The significance of this?
The significance of that was just striking. For the first time involving a Native community, the leadership of the House Democrats turned to these two Native American congresswomen, Charisse Davids and Deb Haaland, and said, why don't you ask the questions first? And so it started with a frame of, here's what Indian countries think, defined by Indian country. And if you think of the long narrative of this country, that is just a shift in many, many ways. It's inspiring. That part of the story, I think, is, wow, this is the way it should have been a long time ago.
This is Carrie Hawk-Lessard, Executive Director of Native American Lifelines, which offers health services in Baltimore and Boston, addressing the hearing on Tuesday.
The partial government shutdown is having dire consequences for American Indian health care, including urban Indian people and urban Indian health. The federal government has an affirmative obligation to provide health care to our people. This trust responsibility stems from treaties and longstanding U.S. policy and jurisprudence. The shutdown of IHS is directly at odds with that obligation. The impact of an IHS shutdown is that already chronically underfunded facilities are forced to make extremely difficult decisions without any other options. Facilities will not be able to provide care to patients.
So, Mark Trahant, final comment on what you feel people need to understand about how this government shutdown in all aspects, education, food, health, employment, treaty obligations, is affecting Native America.
It's hard to understate how important the role of the federal government is in a tribal community. And you're already dealing with a very poor community in many cases. And to have that money stripped out of a community that circulates, even not just the payroll, but so many other ways, to have that taken away so suddenly. I mean, one of the things that was striking in Chairman Payment's testimony was how poorly planned the shutdown was. During the last shutdown, the Bureau of Indian Affairs and other agencies started talking to tribes early, prepaid a lot of the bills, tried to arrange for things so that there would be a mitigation. This time, it just happened. It happened so suddenly because it was after Trump changed course. And that really added to the misery, I think, of what's going on. Indian health is a great example because it's already so underfunded. It's the lowest cost health system in the country. And taking resources out of that just makes it worse.
Mm. Mark Trahant, thanks so much for being with us. Editor of Indian Country Today, member of Shoshone Bannock Tribes. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we go to the first day of hearings for the EPA chief designate, Andrew Wheeler, who is a former coal lobbyist. Stay with us. to Human Justice by Logan Richardson. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn to the Senate confirmation hearing for former coal lobbyist Andrew Wheeler, President Trump's nominee to become the administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency. Wheeler has been the acting head of the EPA since Scott Pruitt resigned in July amidst this onslaught of financial and ethics scandals. Wheeler is a former lobbyist for Murray Energy, the nation's largest underground coal mining company, also the former chief of staff for Oklahoma Republican Senator Jim Inhofe, who is known as the most notorious climate change denying lawmaker in Washington. Shortly after Wheeler began his opening remarks, he was interrupted by protesters.
I'm honored and grateful that President Trump has nominated me for the position of administrator.
Please remove, please restore order. The officers, please restore order in the committee room.
Please. Since taking over as acting director, Andrew Wheeler has overseen proposed rule changes that would make it far easier for coal-fired power plants to release mercury and other toxins into the atmosphere. The plan proposed by the Environmental Protection Agency would change how the federal government calculates the costs of pollution on human health, dramatically downplaying the financial burden to society from deaths and illnesses. Wheeler pledged, if confirmed, he would continue to push the Trump administration's deregulatory and pro-fossil fuel agenda.
The American public has a right to know the truth about the risks they face in their daily lives and how we are responding. It is our responsibility to explain it to them clearly and consistently. This includes recognizing the progress we have made as a nation and where more progress still needs to be made. Through our regulatory reforms, the Trump administration is proving that burdensome federal regulations are not necessary to drive environmental progress. What makes our actions effective and durable is our commitment to vigorously enforce them.
The hearing was marked by tense exchanges with Democratic lawmakers who questioned Wheeler's understanding of recent reports assessing the impact and severity of the climate crisis and his commitment to addressing it. This is Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders.
I found it interesting, Mr. Wheeler. You are the nominee to be head of the Environmental Protection Agency. You just, in your opening statement, did not mention the word climate change. Now, how does it happen that the nominee to be head of the Environmental Protection Agency does not mention the words climate change at a time when the scientific community thinks that climate change is the great environmental crisis facing this planet? Should the American people have confidence that you're going to help us deal with this global crisis?
Yes, they should have confidence because we are moving forward to reduce CO2. Our ACE proposal will reduce CO2 approximately the same levels that the Clean Power Plan would have if it had been implemented. And we're reducing CO2 from our CAFE standards. And we're also addressing greenhouse gases through our methane program as well.
You're addressing.
Yes.
But the scientific community tells us that we have a crisis and that we need unprecedented action.
For more, we're joined by two guests. In Washington, Heather McTeer. Tony is with us, National Field Director for Moms Clean Air Force, inside the hearing room Wednesday, former Southeast Regional Administrator for the EPA under the Obama administration. She also served as the first African-American, first female, and youngest mayor of Greenville, Mississippi. And in San Francisco, California, we're joined by Marianne Hitt, director of the Sierra Club Beyond Coal campaign. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Heather McTeer, Tony, you were in the room as protesters tried to disrupt the hearing. What are your concerns about Andrew Wheeler, the former coal lobbyist, becoming the official head? He's been acting head of the Environmental Protection Agency and his record so far.
Well, thank you so much, first of all, for welcoming us here. And while our moms were in the room, we were there. We were not a part of the active protesters. I think the most you may have heard from us may have been some hungry toddlers, but that was about it. We are there, and we were there to be more concerned and address our issues as mothers. When we see someone who is trying to be the top environmental protection person for our country, who does not even acknowledge climate as a major crisis in this country, in this world, that's a problem for us. Our more than 1 million moms from around this country have dedicated themselves to fighting against air pollution that impacts our children's health. And so we are very, very concerned that Mr. Wheeler is not only not concerned about our children's health and protecting it, but he's not making the active actions that we know need to take place in order to really move this country forward.
I want to go to Oregon Democratic Senator Jeff Merkley questioning the former coal lobbyist Andrew Wheeler.
On a scale of 1 to 10, with 10 being you stay awake night worrying about it, and 1 being it occasionally crosses your mind, how concerned are you about this devastating impact on our nation and the world?
I would say I stay awake at night worrying about a lot of things.
1 to 10. Please answer my question, not answer some other question. 1 to 10 scale, how concerned are you?
8 or 9.
8 or 9. Marianne Hitt, you're the director of the Sierra Club Beyond Coal campaign. Your concerns?
Well, if Andrew Wheeler is an 8 or 9, perhaps the scale should have been a 100, because every single action he has taken since he has been acting administrator has been to roll back climate standards and clean air and water standards, whether it's standards for power plants, for cars, for methane pollution from oil and gas drilling. And as a lead lobbyist for coal industry and for Murray Energy, you know, they have never met an environmental regulation that they did not want to roll back. And he is checking off that wish list of the coal industry. And it is the fox in charge of the hen house. It's the bank robber in charge of the vault, you name it. But this really puts the everyday health and safety of regular Americans at risk, because this is the agency that's inspecting our drinking water facilities and our power plants and chemical plants, cleaning up Superfund sites. And this man just cannot be trusted to lead that agency.
I want to go back to Andrew Wheeler speaking during his confirmation hearing about rollbacks on the Clean Power Plan and mercury and air toxic standard.
Under our preferred option, I do not believe there'd be a weakening in the mercury standards at all as far as the equipment that has already been deployed and implemented across the board. Thank you. I don't think you can, I get accused of rolling back the Clean Power Plan. I don't think you can roll back a regulation that never took effect. And on MATS, I don't think you can roll back a regulation that's been fully implemented.
Marianne Hitt, the Sierra Club published an article saying Wheeler cooked the books to help coal barons with regard to the mercury and air toxic standards, or MATS. Explain this.
So mercury gets into our bodies because it comes out of the power plants, gets into the water and the fish that we eat, and it poses a real threat, especially to little babies and small children. And what they have done, it is just, his comments are so cynical, it's shocking. But what they have done is that when they passed the mercury standards in the Obama administration, it also cleaned up a lot of other pollution, a lot of other kinds of air pollution, the kinds of air pollution linked to things like heart attacks and strokes. And what they're trying to do here is to say, in putting forward this mercury standard, you can't count all those other benefits to public health. All you can count is the very narrow category of mercury, which is a big public health problem, very important, but you can't count all those other public health benefits. And now it's important to note this rule has taken effect. Every coal plant in the country has complied with the mercury standards. Mercury levels have fallen 80% from power plants in the last 10 years. This is a huge public health success, but they're trying to say you cannot count all those other health benefits. And really ultimately tip the scales so that the benefits of these public health rules look smaller, the costs look greater, and they can make the case going forward that they can really narrowly look at the benefits of these public health protections to make the case that they should be weaker or shouldn't have to comply with them at all. So it's really trying to tip the scales in favor of polluters and against public health. And mercury is an issue that affects all Americans. It's in the fish that we eat. Moms care about it so much. Any woman who's been to the doctor has been warned away from eating fish with high levels of mercury. And so this is a real bread and butter issue for folks. And they're trying to put their finger on the scale in favor of the big polluters, which is typical for Andrew Wheeler and typical of, I think, what we would expect of him going forward.
New research from Harvard University finds Trump's plan to roll back Obama-era climate regulations in favor of more industry-friendly policy under the Affordable Clean Energy Act will result in a, quote, rebound in global warming and is worse than the government doing nothing to combat climate change. Trump's plans, which included delaying the closure of coal-fired power plants, would lead to an increase in carbon dioxide emissions of 8.7% in 18 states and Washington, D.C. by 2030, compared to having no policy. Heather McTeer-Tony, if you can respond to this.
unconscionable and unfathomable that we're talking about putting someone in this position who's not even read the reports that we're referring to. He's not even been brought up to speed or found it important enough or concerned himself enough to go and research this information for himself. Our mothers have at least done that. The international report and even the national climate assessment that our own government conducted has confirmed from us that within the next 12 years, if we do not take some action to reduce carbon emissions in this country, that we will be in a position that is irreversible. I'm the mother of three. My youngest is 2 years old. That means that by the time he turns 14, before he is able to drive and before he has graduated from high school, we will be in a position where we cannot reverse the effects of extreme weather events in this country. This is not an issue that he has the option of thinking about whether or not it's impacting our country. It is critical to the health and survival of all American citizens, particularly the least of us, our elderly and our children. And it's very disappointing for mothers to know that he's not even concerned about this.
I wanted to talk about the effects of the shutdown on the climate. Website Inside Climate News recently reported the government shutdowns effectively halted several climate-related government efforts. They include the EPA's work on studying the impact of wildfires on air and water quality, health and the environment, and research and development from the National Hurricane Center on forecasting models for the next hurricane season. Climate scientists are also concerned about possible gaps in data collection if instruments that assess planetary changes malfunction due to lack of maintenance. Finally, Heather McTiertoni, if you could comment on that, but also, I mean, you were the youngest mayor of Greenville, Mississippi. Then you went on to the Obama administration. Why have you focused your activism on the climate?
Yeah, it's a very good question, and one that a lot of good friends have asked is why at this point in time is this the focus? And I believe wholeheartedly that if this is not the activism, if this is not the social justice movement, if this is not what we are concerning ourselves with right now, then everything else is for naught. We have one planet. We have one Earth. And it is imperatively important that we do what we can right now within the limited time scope that we have to make sure that we are in a sustainable and livable community. Working for the Environmental Protection Agency, there's one thing that I always remembered, and that is the first part of our mission statement was to protect human health and the environment. Human health, because without that, we have nothing. And so it is critically important for not only me, but also our more than 1 million moms, dads, grandmothers, cousins, and aunts around this country to come together and make sure we are very vocal and activists in assuring that climate and our protections for our children are the top priority in this country.
And can you talk about how communities of color are particularly impacted on the front lines of in their proximity, for example, to coal-fired plants?
You know, over a million African Americans live within 1 mile of an oil and gas operation. And a lot of people don't recognize that fence line and frontline communities are the first people who are impacted by any change in regulation. So when we talk about the rollback of MATS, the mercury and air toxic standards, and the fact that the simplest thing that we all should make sure of is that we're not putting poison in the air that impacts unborn babies, that impacts children. And when that's done, the first place it gets to are those fence line and those frontline communities of color. Those are the people that are impacted first. And so to see this administration even moving in the direction of not only impacting unborn babies, their brains, because that's what mercury does, but then it is to the communities of color. Again, it is unimaginable that we're even still considering having Andrew Wheeler as the nominee when he has so evidently shown his disregard for communities of color and for young children. So as you can tell, I'm very passionate about this. But I think it's also important for us to know that our moms are working, that we know that there are activists that are out here that are not sitting quietly
Heather
by.
Heather McTiertoni, we're going to have to leave it there. National Field Director for Moms Clean Air Force and Marianne Hitt, Director of the Sierra Club's Beyond Coal campaign. That does it for our broadcast. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.